This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you all very, very much. We're going to have some fun this evening, discussion elections 2016. You folks in California have the longest ballot ever. We have the first woman ever on a major ticket. We also have a woman on the green ticket. Running together, and we have a businessman with not a lot of political experience in the past, other than negotiating over permits, perhaps, running on the GOP ticket. It's a fascinating time. But before we get, I want to just say how fortunate I think we all are, particularly me, to be in San Diego, because I love coming to this community. I love meeting people like I have here on the panel, and I'm going to shortly introduce. And I also like to see what I saw today, which is today a medical center opened up today. The UCSD Jacobs met Irwin and Joan Jacobs here, the Irwin and Joan Jacobs Medical Center. So open today, ribbon cutting today. So thank you. big tribute. Now let me introduce you to our lucky panel. I feel like I'm introducing sort of a reality show here to get started. But first of all, we have Scott Lewis. Scott Lewis has a very big deal starting tomorrow, the fifth time he's launched PolitiFest. He is the editor of Voice of San Diego, the leading nonprofit, the first digital nonprofit news organization here in San Diego. He seems to know all of the editors at The Atlantic, trying to hire them away, I understand, and so we'll try to keep them here. But it's an outstanding program. I'm going to ask Scott in a little while to talk a little bit about what's lined up, and I understand that this is really the launch of the evening, but then you're going to move over to San Diego State for the balance of it. So yeah. is that about right?
Yeah, I have to pick up the keynote speaker in the morning at his hotel, and then it's all day long, and then there's an after party at the bowling alley. So
okay, great. Well, you heard the important parts, the beginning and the end, and you can do other stuff during the middle. We have Laura Fink, who is a strategic communications consultant, a principal with Fink and Hernandez Consulting. She was a senior political strategist to Speaker Emeritus of the California State Assembly, Tony Atkins, and I think still is one of the four original founders of a great organization, Run Women Run. Inspiring women to run for political office. This is something I recently met Justin Trudeau, the new Prime Minister of Canada, who's essentially mimicked this organization to try to get women to run and represent and appear in both appointed positions but also elected positions in Canada. Very interesting. She appears every Wednesday and Friday on San Diego Fox 5. I neglected to mention that Scott is a regular feature on NBC 7. And basically, she also performs Shakespeare and watches sports. Probably at the same time. Thad Kauser is professor and department chair here in the Department of Politics at UC San Diego. He's the co-editor of the Legislative Studies Quarterly. He has really cool political stories, which we might get into, of his time as a page in the New York State Assembly. He worked in Washington on a fellowship for Senator Ron Wyden. Very diverse political experience. But I just want to note one thing. He's become an expert on tweeting on Twitter. He has issued a tweet-style paper that I hope he'll talk to us a little bit about. And he's become very, very familiar with Donald Trump's tweets and looking at the impact, the sort of sociology and anthropology of Donald Trump tweets. What's interesting to me that he himself had, until about an hour ago, 42 followers on Twitter, and I want to commend him for that. I became the 43rd. Laura, and he is at Thad Kauser, so you can do that. Laura K. Fink is her Twitter address, has 1,271 followers, and Scott Lewis at VOSD Scott has over 12,000. So you win the first round of the campaign. So thank you all. Let me start with you, Laura. I was out walking with the audience a little while ago, met some folks, and said, what would you like to hear about? And one of the interesting questions that we started, and I just want to, make you defend something. But
fantastic.
Excellent. What do you think would have happened if Bernie Sanders had beaten Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary and was now running against Donald Trump? What would that mean in terms of this election? What would it look like? And what would that mean for divisions in society? And we're seeing Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton head to a what may be a collision Monday night in the first debate, moderated by my colleague Lester Holt of NBC. But if it was Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, what do you think would be happening?
God, that's such a fascinating question and one that I almost feel ill-equipped to answer. And the odd thing about being considered a political aficionado and someone who talks about these things is that this election is so different than any other one. You almost feel like a lot of your experience, it may or may not be relevant to the current situation. But I think in terms of Bernie, I think, you know, one of the interesting things that and one of the reasons that was proffered by Democrats in not wanting him to succeed would be because he's not viable. He is not viable in the face of being a democratic socialist and in the face of an opponent. But of course, these conversations were happening before we had solidified Trump on the other side. I think it would be a very interesting race. I do think that he might, because it was sort of fighting fire with fire, a galvanized, energized progressive base, but there are questions about whether his viability would hold because he, you know, did lack a certain energy in a lot of the different, more diverse communities that are part of the Democratic Party. Whether or not he would be able to bring those home, well, you know, we don't really know. But I think it would be a very different race. I think it certainly would have made for great TV, but I think Hillary probably is a little better match.
Jump to Hillary Clinton for a minute and. You know, apply what you just said to her, because does she naturally carry the constituencies that were very supportive of Bernie Sanders into her campaign on this? Do you think that's been seamless?
Well, I don't think it's been seamless, but I think that it's possible. And I see our UCSD young Democrats are here tonight in full force in the front row.
Do we have any UCSD young Republicans in the room, you know, just to be fair?
Both of them.
You're the Republican? Yeah, okay, good.
But one of the data coming out of what's been happening with respect to millennial voters is fascinating. Many, the lion's share of whom were Bernie voters in the primary. But what the data is showing is that ultimately, millennials are extremely progressive, and they do share a lot, especially in contrast to Donald Trump, a lot of the policy positions that Hillary holds, but they don't necessarily know that she holds those positions. A lot of the millennial voters were so focused on Bernie Sanders, and because of the dynamic of the race, and certainly the dynamic after, where we're not talking about issues a lot, they're not necessarily informed. However, you know, a lot of the polling shows that when they are informed, they come home.
Before I go to Thad, I want to ask you one last question. If you were to give Donald Trump some key strategic advice for the debate Monday night on how to really win that debate, what would you tell him?
Show up and don't get out of control, I think. And you know what? Get people to take you a little more seriously by just simply coming close to meeting the bar on policy. Surprise them. I think that would be shocking.
Well,
I
got to ask you.
Yeah.
What do you think Bernie Sanders would be doing right now? Would he be outperforming Hillary Clinton?
I think Bernie Sanders energized people in such a surprising and shocking way. I was completely bowled over. I've had the privilege of knowing him for a long time. I don't think that he knew that he could do that. I think that the first time he showed up, and a lot of people are outside a building, and he was, you know, it's on record, he was totally shocked they were there for him. So he was completely caught off guard by his own success. It raises, I think, more interesting questions that not only if Bernie had run, but if Joe Biden had run, that there's something out there about a group of Americans who feel left behind, demeaned, looked down on, and somehow he connected with those people. I recently interviewed Vice President Biden for a piece called The Biden Doctrine in The Atlantic. And if you take a look at the ending of the article, he veers off. And I had asked him, I said, you know, isn't it, you're one of the people in the country that people know can talk to regular folks. Isn't it odd for you that Donald Trump is now that person? And he really indicted both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party leadership for being rich and disregarding how the lives of real people were. And he really gave most of the criticism to the Democratic Party elite. So I think if Bernie Sanders had been there, it would be different. But then you would have the elites of both parties, not just the Republican Party, because the New York finance community has no party today. And there's a New York finance part of the Democratic establishment that wouldn't have a party today. So it's a very interesting challenge. But here, let me turn it back over to you. We have Hillary and Donald Trump running. I've been driven around by a number of folks here looking for Trump signs and Hillary Clinton signs, and I've been surprised that I haven't seen much of either.
No, we did a story.
Have I been in the wrong neighborhoods?
I actually saw a Hillary's bumper sticker the other day. I said, there's one, there's a bumper sticker.
So what's going on? Do you guys feel like you're in a different country?
Well, so we surveyed all of the local Republican leaders in the city of San Diego, asking them if they supported Trump, and the responses were incredible. Even the chairman of the Republican Party.
Enthusiasm?
Not
never
at
give
all.
Up, never surrender.
He said even the chairman of the local Republican Party, a very fiery, passionate Republican, immigrant himself, and just a real convert to the whole cause. He wouldn't even say that he endorsed him. And the mayor, the city council people, over and over. Now there are some congressmen, there's some people in the East County, and some legislators and stuff that are obviously very passionate for Trump. But it was fascinating. It's like we live in a different dimension here. With that, even our mayor, Republican mayor, he's for a pathway to citizenship. Voted for that when he's on the council. He's helped pass one of the most ambitious climate action plans in the country. I mean, this is not somebody who would compete well on that Republican stage.
Who would Mayor Faulkner have supported among the 17 candidates?
I think it was Rubio. Is that right? There you go.
Yeah. Rubio. Oh, we've got the mayor's assistant. Yeah. So it's Marco Rubio.
There was he got pushed pretty hard. I pushed him at a debate. I asked him, and he wouldn't say. He actually would say that he was against Trump, and he stood with it. And he got a lot of pressure for that.
So I want to make sure that in this discussion we don't find everyone on the same side. I want to ask Thad, identify for me the top three redeeming qualities of Mr. Trump. Like, and I mean this not as a joke, but as a serious. He won the GOP nomination. He is ahead of Hillary Clinton in a lot of parts of the country, not everywhere. New polls came out where she's now 6 points ahead nationally. She's pulled it. But I tell you, 1 week ago, she was looking wobbly in Ohio, in North Carolina, in Florida, key battleground states. And he had momentum. There's just no doubt. Her numbers went down 17 points with millennials, and her numbers after August suffered quite a bit. So what is turbocharging Donald Trump in as a political scientist without any bias, right? Give us the answer.
Yeah, this is the question, right, that everyone, whether they're Republicans in the country club or Democrats in academia, sitting around saying, this guy who's nothing like us has this extraordinary appeal. What's going on? So one of those things is, if you just read Donald Trump quotes in the newspaper, or you see a few bits of him, right? He seems outrageous. When you watch him for 5 or 10 minutes, he's not, right? He's an extraordinary personal communicator in small town hall meetings, in the 5 minute interview segment. He comes across as someone where you can see what his values and he's so one of those is his sort of telegenic personal communication presence, right? Second thing is he's absolutely mastered social media like no one has so far in politics, right? So he drove the news cycle with tweet after tweet after tweet, sucked
up all
the oxygen.
Do you read every tweet of Donald Trump?
Not, we have computer algorithms to do that, but I read a lot of them, right?
And your knowledge is incomplete then?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
I will admit that, but his tweets have been the story, and that sucked all the oxygen out of the room so that everyone else in this field of 16 Republicans just couldn't get their message out because he was driving that news cycle by saying things both outrageous and smart. And third is that he's reacted to world situations better than his opponents have. So when you've seen him rise
what,
in the polls.
Friendship with Vladimir Putin, or he says nice things about me? I mean, I'm just interested in what he has reacted to in the world situation that you think he's done better.
Yeah, so why did he come up in the polls in the first time? Why did he get his election bounce? That started before his convention bounce. That started before the convention when the terrorist attack happened in Nice and the police shootings happened in Dallas, right? And he crafted a message very quickly that was comforting, authoritarian, and was strong leadership. What's going on now with violence in the streets? In Charlotte, he's talking about keep America safe and great. Sorry, make America safe and great again, right? If his language has changed, right? He's going to have to re-stencil the hats, but he's changing his message based on what's going on in the world, and that's leadership in a lot of people's mind.
May I offer?
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
So I think there's something about this election that's been really interesting for me to watch in the sense of there is I would call it the explanation and villainization election. This is where it's become very clear. who Donald Trump blames for problems. Now, whether they're deserving of that or not, it's very clear. They're immigrants. It's you know, outsiders. It's foreigners. It's foreign trade deals. It's that sort of thing.
Barack Obama.
It's Barack Obama. It's the insiders. It's the finance, or it's the whatever, Washington insiders, all that stuff. And I think if you were to ask, well, who does Hillary Clinton think is to blame for everything that people might be complaining about? And I'm not sure people could identify who she thinks is to blame for everything. Bernie Sanders, you could. But I think that's what makes the, I'm not saying that's good, by the way. I think this is probably an indication of something that's wrong in our politics, that we're lifting up the people who are better at blaming somebody for everything that's wrong. But I feel like that's what...
Well, for Hillary, it's the what they call the alt-right community, the far-right-wing conspiracy.
She doesn't,
I mean,
like...
She has people out there that she does see as the source of all her problems.
She does identify those people as deplorable, as actual problems, but she doesn't identify them as what's causing the problem, right? I think what was special about watching Bernie Sanders was that, you know, I didn't agree with a lot of it, but he tried to
what
lay out...
What part did you agree with?
I'm pretty passionate about universal health care. I think that people should have universal health care. You know, it's one of the things I'm most liberal about. But I think...
What are you most conservative about?
Public employee unions and, you know, some fiscal thing.
That's
I think
a tweetable moment right there. I just want to...
I think
I'm shocked at hearing this, really.
I think the government is good at a few things, and yeah. They should be really good at them. And I really worry about people that don't have access to good schools and healthcare. Sorry.
Healthcare brought to you by the union movement, daughter of two labor union members.
No,
here.
I said public employees union. I think that the
oh, you're okay with
market
non-public.
Unions have done great work, yeah. And I don't even have a problem with them. I just think there's some negative influences sometimes in some local government situations that I've been privy to.
Laura,
so,
let me ask.
No, yeah. But just quickly, I think that what Sanders did that was really interesting was really just laid out a reason why the world was the way it was, right? His speeches helped you understand at least a worldview. And socialism's good at that, by the way, at like explaining why something is the way it is. And so I think that was probably wrong in some ways. But I think that Trump has a different version of that, which is like, we can protect Social Security, we can protect Medicare, but you also don't have to like these people still, and you can hate the environmentalists and the immigrants and other things still, and we can protect those benefits. But I think that but they both provided that narrative that was comforting and easy to follow. And I think that Hillary is providing a narrative that's, we can keep managing things well.
Thank you. Let me ask the three of you, and Laura, you go first. To give Hillary Clinton some advice in a second. I have about 100 relatives, third and fourth and fifth cousins, second cousins in Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, and I've done a poll of them, and about out of the 100, 97 of them support Mr. Trump. And I've tried to understand and unpack what's going on in their mind and how they see it, and as best I can tell, they see Donald Trump as a wrecking ball. They see him as someone who... no matter what he does, is that they have always been lied to in the past, as they see it, that someone was going to go to Washington and change Washington, that there was an outsider. With him, they get a genuine sense that he will come and make everybody in D.C. have a really bad, bad time. And that turns them on. And they feel left behind and neglected, and they see Washington as a cesspool of corrupt relationships that have harmed their interests. They see Hillary Clinton as someone who, along with her husband and their franchise and the Clinton Global Initiative and all these relationships, basically as someone who's very conventional and will come back and be the queen of D.C., and there's a moat around it, and you couldn't trust them before, you can't trust them now. And I'm interested in that. I think that frame is an actual genuine frame of many of the supporters of Donald Trump and even many of the independents that are looking at it. They see her as someone who's distant from regular Americans. They see as someone who, as the more he lies, the more he gets things wrong, the more he has seven different versions of what his views on Mexico and migration are, that's all good because it means he's going to be reckless. How do you help Hillary Clinton reach those people who see him as a wrecking ball and want a wrecking ball?
Well, so much to unpack in your statement.
So do you agree with my statement?
I think that there is certainly an element of that. I don't think that that's the key to Hillary winning, although it would be wonderful if she could appeal to those folks. I mean, I think if I was Hillary, I wouldn't go near a casino because she's honestly been so electorally unlucky in her runs for president. The first time she draws the most charismatic, campaign savant, dynamic, like world-beating politician we've seen in decades, if not generations, depending on how you feel about Bill or Ronald Reagan. But I think, you know, so that draw was difficult. Now she is she cannot help who she is. And as I talk to political candidates, you can't turn yourself into something you're not. She can't run as an outsider change maker. She can't run as a wrecking ball. That is not who she is. And I will say this too, that I think our first woman president would never be a wrecking ball, would never be an outside force, because there are certain requirements in order to be strong and to be nominated, which, as we talked about at lunch, I will go into and talk ad nauseum about. But to answer your question, I think her play really is to play to her strengths. She needs to just own the workhorse, not a show horse. I think she needs to dig in and just talk about issues relentlessly and just without, I mean, she may get the airtime, she may not, but I think the outside groups will play to the cycle. I think she can start at the debate because that's a forum that she will have the opportunity to discuss things like healthcare and the environment and race relations. There are two sort of lanes that she needs to travel in. The first is she needs to energize the base by talking about these things that they're not hearing about. The anemia is not just because people feel differently about her because she's an insider. I think it's also because of the lack of space, campaign space, with Donald Trump sucking all the air out of the room. So she needs to find that space and to really drive toward it. And then I also think that she needs to, she is going to work to try to pull in those dissatisfied Trump supporters, those Republicans that Scott is talking about. And this isn't brain surgery, but it is surgery. And she is going to have to be surgical about it. And it's not an easy task. So I think that is her play.
How many of you used to watch the McLaughlin Report? And you know, John McLaughlin just passed away recently. Do any of you know the McLaughlin Report? It's on YouTube. You can go back. So I'm going to play the role of John McLaughlin. Laura, you're wrong.
Of course.
You gave very good advice, but I think that one of the interesting problems, Hillary Clinton's big problem connecting with independents and with those that have been supporting Trump is the trust issue. They don't trust her. They we've seen it whether she's been harassed or not. And you know, I think if I were running her campaign or giving, if I were Laura Fink or we were Fink and Clemens and a political, I'd say,
thanks for putting
show
me first.
How you can turn around this trust issue. Embed media and journalists wherever you go. When you have a cough and you get diagnosed with walking pneumonia, say it right away. I mean, so let's go into the truth, because I think that's her problem, being a workhorse in all of these other issues or not. But Americans somehow, and perhaps it's unfair, don't think they can trust her.
Well, again, I go back to, you're not wrong, but okay, there's a reason she's not comfortable. When you have had the cloud of scandal and survived it over 30 years, inborn in you as a 69-year-old woman, you are inherently distrustful of the press. So I think her handlers will get her to do a little bit more of that. But in fact, what has made her successful is the way that she's handled things thus far. And now, of course, the media environment's changed, the dynamics have changed, and she's gonna have to change some of that. I completely agree with that. But I also think what is discounted is the fact that all of these things that have become poison pills to her, her political husband, her insider status, clearing the primary to clear the deck, all of the mountains of political favors, her 30 years in the global spotlight, and her network and really understanding of insider power is what got her here. And in fact, I would argue that was required of female candidates generally. So to separate these out now that we're in campaign mode and say, well, she should just naturally embed the press, I understand that point and it's not wrong, but I also understand the 40-year aversion to doing it because it hasn't worked well for her.
Look, we got 6 weeks till the campaign goes. Americans are not suddenly going to start trusting Hillary Clinton.
Thank you.
She can't start the Straight Talk Express.
But what are the debates about then?
Well, the debates are about a chance for her to do all the other things we like about Hillary, right? She's solid. She's an expert. She's smart. She knows what she's talking about. And she can get the people who are already open to her to love her.
What do you think is going to happen in the debates? Like, just be a prognosticator.
Look, she wants to let Donald Trump be the bully, right? Because what, you know, why is he, one of the reasons why he's come up so much in the last 4 weeks is he had a sort of campaign shakeup and he just has stopped doing stupid, mean things, right? He's just stayed out of the news and not screwed up, right? So she wants to give him the opportunity, right? And so I think, you know, as much as she can bait him into doing that, she'll do that. And I think she'll be the steady, low variance, right? We've never seen her give a great speech. We've never seen her give a disastrous speech. And I think that's what we're going to see over this debate.
And I'm just going to jump in there and say that I also think that she is going to try to Sarah Palin him. So she's going to be there and she's going to slow
on.
And
that's
say,
a very interesting.
No. She's going to try to
you
have
you just
a,
hurt my head.
Russia.
So what? How is she going to do that?
Well, I think she is going to use her policy knowledge, and if there is any interaction between them, she's going to try to get him to say something that is not informed.
Because Sarah Palin so often used her policy knowledge?
No. Trump is Palin, right?
Right.
She's going to make him look
okay.
bad.
Right. Sorry, that's why
you're...
Okay, I just got it.
I will say, I have no idea what's going to happen on Monday. But I will say, like, what would be really fun to watch and would be special, I think, is if she... if she were to identify why she's so worried about climate change, or why she's so worried about childcare, or why she's so worried about inequality in the workplace, or why, if she was able to really educate people and just kind of authentically talk about why those things concern her, then I think she can make Donald Trump look petty and be almost contemptuous toward him. Because he doesn't care about these
things.
So
my friend Dana Milbank of the Washington Post had a line about Hillary Clinton saying there's no one better on the national stage of turning triumph into tedium. And I'm interested in, as people talk about drilling down and giving these policy lectures and going whether that works.
No, I don't mean a policy lecture.
Okay.
You're talking
I mean authentically say what she cares about and why she's so worried about the things that she's worried about, which is our genuine forces. When we talk about the villains, Trump identifies immigrants. Trump identifies all these outsider groups. Trump identifies people who, you know, are different or whatever. And what she would identify is actual forces, actual problems, like climate change, like education inequality, inequality and universal access to different services and all of these in the environment. And I think if she were to, she would identify that, not get into like carbon taxes and not get into like actual specific things that are going to maybe bore people, but if she were to identify that there are more important things out there than whatever petty tweet that he's focused on that day, I think that would be powerful. Now, if he gets her into the debate that he has, into his world, I think that his world is not some place you can win. And I think every single Republican rival that he had got into that world with him and lost his game. And she just has to make him look petty. And I don't think that's easy. I don't think that her, you know...
Let me ask the three of you to critique the media for a minute. Critique me, all my colleagues. I wonder how responsible or irresponsible we've been in this election, whether the way we, you know, Donald Trump has said and tweeted something, the media needs me, our ratings need me, their ratings need me. And, you know, we've gone through some shows like Chuck Todd and John Dickerson. John Dickerson was CBS and Chuck Todd at MSNBC and NBC said they wouldn't take any more of the phone call interviews. And I have to say that in the kind of roller coaster ride between Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough and Donald Trump, one where they're very chummy at the beginning, then at war, now they're trying to get chummy again, it seems. I'm wondering, tell me what you think about the media coverage broadly of the election, and did we produce Trump? I'm giving you a big opportunity here just to slam us.
No,
you guys are all very intimidated, like, uh-oh.
Let me just say that there's no such thing as the media. There's each one of us is different. There's Breitbart, there's...
Yeah, you are the media, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so where have you gone wrong?
Well, I think that the media... When people frame debates effectively, effective communicators frame debates, and Donald Trump is one of those people that... He says, do you want to buy this fridge or do you want to buy that fridge? Do you want to get the red or the blue? And then by the time he's got you to decide whether you want the red or the blue, you have chosen to buy it. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Because you've already made he's already gotten you arguing about that point. And that's what he's so brilliant at. He really is a showbiz. His campaign was a studio. His campaign wasn't a campaign.
But isn't it your job, Scott, to see through that?
Absolutely. And that's why we launched San Diego Fact Check and a bunch of other. No. But we focused on explanation and investigation on the local level. And I think there's plenty of the Washington Post, a bunch of places around the country that have been doing some fantastic investigative work. But I think we can't blame the media for somebody who is able to rise up and make a point that gets people arguing that they then follow. Now, should they be better about it? Should they hold it to a higher standard? Should they make more intelligent decisions? Sure, but somebody else will do the lizard brain stuff. You know, somebody else will do.
So, Mr. Political Scientist, do you think there's something wrong if Donald Trump gets about $2 billion of free media in comparison we did? And how would you compare that to the coverage with Hillary Clinton, who was pretty dark in August? And before that, she got a lot of coverage on emails, got a lot of coverage on Benghazi, got a lot of coverage on some of the Libya stuff. But when you go out and look
Lucky
at things
girl.
That
yeah.
she proactively put on the table, and Clinton Global Initiative, all the donors that she answered phone calls for. So, but the question is, when you begin looking at this question of candidates putting forward proposals and ideas, I see Trump, I don't see Hillary. Tell me where I'm wrong.
He hasn't been putting forth proposals. He's been putting forth ideas
wall,
and provocative ones.
Walking away from NATO. Putin's a good guy.
Yeah, they're easy to cover, right? She's been putting forth white papers. And you know, her campaign team knew those weren't going to sell, right? So they,
I mean, you
use the term free media.
You produce white papers.
And nobody reads them, and I know that, but that's okay, right? But I'm not running for president, right? So she didn't make any strategic change, right? He mastered this. We saw what happened. You use the word free media, but in Laura's world, nobody uses the word free media. It's earned media, right? And he really did earn that by saying interesting, provocative things and setting up shows. And so the fact, so it's easy to sit back and critique the media when they do, the birther press conference last week where he got an hour and a half of free time when he said three sentences at the end. And it was just, an empty mic, and people were doing it because he had promised to say something major.
Right.
Right? And by the way, he did it in his own hotel and got all this free advertising for it. But that was on him. He earned it. The media responded in a pretty rational way to go where the ratings were. It's no accident that this is going to be 100 million people watching the debate. It's going to be the Super Bowl. It's going to be,
but does that excuse it?
Yeah, because the media is a company, right? You are a market. They are responding effectively to what the public wants to see. I think that's part of it.
I would love to keep talking about this, but and I think there are a lot of topics that we may get to into in questions. What's boiling now in Charlotte? The ongoing issues on the hot button issues that have been taken at both Hillary and Donald Trump, but they're not the whole show. There happened to be an election with other stuff going on. There is more going on than Trump and Hillary Clinton. I just want everybody to know.
But Steve, might I critique the media for a moment since my colleagues have not done so?
I was trying to cut you out. Go ahead.
I just will say one thing because we can. I don't disagree that obviously the profit motivator was there, but and some of this is a Trump skill. And I don't agree with everything you said, Professor, about to his credit, but he's certainly been able to sell cacophony and use that to kind of overwhelm the media from fact-checking individual things as Scott does. And so he creates, there's so much to fact-check, there's so much to do. And they do debunk some of it, and some of it people don't seem to care whether it's debunked or not. So that's part of it. The other part of it is...
Let me just do a poll here. And I mean, Irwin and Joan, you care about fact-checking, I know, so we're not going to count you. You're just... But let's do... Who cares about fact-checking? Yeah, that's why you're at UC San Diego. I need to go find another room of folks. Anybody not care so much about fact-checking? No brave souls. If you were to... I feel the need to say, because I know some Glenn Klessler at the Post and some really... I was looking at what you've been doing on fact-checking today. It's important, but a lot of people say that's not what this is about.
Well,
that it's about... something more than that.
Well, there's accountability to point out that it's not truthful, and when people can do what they want with that. And Matt Lauer being the sterling example of that not happening, but certainly many, many others. The other piece I think that is missing is the investigative side to all of Trump, all of Trump's potential issues. And I think part of that is that Hillary's just much easier to investigate. She's a public figure. Her schedules are there. The FOIA Act was responded to. And you can do that with all of the things that are available. I think it's much easier to do. It's an easier story. Now, deploying someone to go and try and subpoena emails from Pam Bondi and dig into that is much harder. So that's where I really hold the media account. Why aren't you doing the hard work in addition to rolling in the dough?
What did they are. I mean, David Fahrenthold at the Washington Post I think he deserves a Pulitzer for the investigative work he's done on the foundation and the nonsense that Trump has done. But what Trump has really
But that is the only example.
No, that is not the only example. The New York Times, several others have done tremendous work on it. But I think what's hard about it is you have a man who, I mean, Marco Rubio called him a con man for a reason. And he's saying, I don't care. I am a con man. So I'm going to be your con man.
So I think
that's power. But I think
let's break let me that just down. Say, Marco Rubio is now supporting Donald Trump. Ted Cruz is now supporting Donald Trump.
Because they have acknowledged that, yes.
Now, George H.W. Bush is supporting Hillary Clinton.
Yes, but the number and volume of stories done on Hillary Clinton, it's just a matter of math. There have been far more done on those two or three issues. And the volume of Trump potential and then the lovely and really brilliant stories that you've pointed out are really just a small sliver of the potential.
I mean, I'd like to see the data on that. There is tremendous amount of investigative work about Donald Trump out there. I mean, there's aggregations of lists of these incredible stories that have been done. But I think like what he's also showing is that if you don't have any shame at all, that we all believe in the political and media spheres that if we point out that somebody's corrupt, that the mayor's done something or that this has happened, that they'll be forced to deal with it and then they eventually resign. I've been a part of several of those dramas just on the local basis where we find something out and it keeps coming and somebody eventually resigns. And I think what he's saying is, I don't care what you find. And you know, he's not being punished for it, and that's terrifying. And I think we should be terrified. But I don't think it's about the reporters not caring about it.
I just want the audience to know that I'm working really hard to get to discussion of the 17th state of California ballot propositions and 12 cities of San Diego propositions. I'm trying really hard, but see, it's hard to go deep
into these
regional things. But no, I don't want to leave Hillary and Trump yet. Let's think ahead, okay? Either Donald Trump wins or Hillary wins. I think my question is, if Hillary wins, we have this vision of Hillary, can Hillary be Hillary, given what we've seen from Bernie Sanders, given this kind of revolution that the Republican Party, in my mind, can't ever be the same again. When you have Paul Wolfowitz, who helped lead the invasion of Iraq, leading neoconservative, former Deputy Secretary of Defense under Bush 2, and you have Brent Scowcroft, who the two of them really hate each other, who was National Security Advisor to Bush 1, and both of them are supporting Hillary Clinton. You ask, what is this party going to look like later? But then you've got the Bernie Sanders, a lot of the millennials not joining Hillary Clinton. So say Hillary wins. Can Hillary Clinton be Hillary Clinton, or does she need to deglobalize a little bit, begin looking at a lot more of these internal? Is she driven by some of what Trump has surfaced to be different? And I think likewise with Donald Trump, does the system of checks and balances that we have in our government that the founders set up, did they anticipate something? Will the government work with a Donald Trump who seems not to know about all those checks and balances things? Will it continue to function? So just quick answer on that, because I do want to get to what's happening locally.
Donald Trump is exactly the candidate our Constitution was framed to constrain, right? This is what the founders were worried about. They were worried about a populist candidate, a demagogue, and so they set up all these checks and balances that will essentially, if he wins this election, cripple any major policy movement, but that's okay because he doesn't have a big policy agenda, right? So he's not trying to move a ton of things through the Senate, and so the filibuster is just not going to be that big a deal for him. So he will not have the ability to move policy hugely in America in any sphere except for foreign policy. That's the clearest.
That's a pretty big chunk.
Yep.
Scott?
I think what worries me is we saw a mayor for a while here who was unhinged in a way. He was a bully in a way. he had the same sort of simplistic outlook on things. You know, we can fix this. We can solve homelessness. We can fix the park. We can do.
I'm going to say, Mayor, I'm so sorry. And yeah, we.
No, not the.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
No, I'm just. I know this. Not this mayor is here, but.
But what
you
was,
never know who's in the audience, right?
But what he did, and I'm not even going to mention his name. But what he did was he.
They all know.
He explored the creases of power in City Hall in a way that hadn't been done. He would stop inspectors from going to a building unless to look at the building. Unless the developer forked over some money to a foundation type thing, and what he did was he realized like you could pull a little deal out of each little thing, however unethical or corrupt or problematic it was. And what I worry about is I think that is the same type of person becomes the president, and we watch the same type of whiplash in government. And yet, at this, we're talking about trade deals. We're talking about NATO. We're talking about these incredible creases of power that he might be able to get in there and mess with. And that's terrifying. And so, I'm quite worried about it. But maybe we just want to rock the boat, huh?
Laura, can Hillary be Hillary?
I think she can, because I think that running things is what she's good at. And I think also what heartens me as a progressive is knowing that ultimately the numbers, particularly with young people, are on the progressive side. I mean, all of the data suggests that on every issue from climate change to healthcare to everything, there is untapped resources there. Now, the question is, can she sort of tack through a Congress that is divided, at best by her perception she'll have the Senate and not the House? So can she somehow galvanize that group without being a purist by making the compromises that she'll need to get some things done? I mean, that is ultimately her challenge, or the challenge of anyone that would enter the office at this time. So I don't think there's any other way than for Hillary to be Hillary.
Interesting. Let me go local, and let's go into the state and some of these initiatives that we're going in. And I, you know, there's so many. I've got a lot of files here.
It's bananas.
But I am interested in the sort of state of democracy, and we have a lot of San Diegan citizens here who are in this. I know you've written a proposal. I was just reading about the ultimate guide to the ballot measures that you've just released. It looks really cool. It's got nice graphics and all this that you put out. Do you tell people how to vote, or do you just tell them how?
No, we're a nonprofit. We don't take a side. We realize that people are going to be faced with a ballot that it's going to be two cards. So you're going to get two cards in the mail or at the ballot box, two full sheets of decisions to make, dozens of local and state initiatives.
So
everything from pot to porn to firearms.
Thad recently wrote a piece really lambasting this process, saying this is not how democracy should really work. If I can put words in your mouth that these, you know, yeah, I mean, you can clarify. But, you know, I think that you were basically saying this is too much. In the initiatives. Did I read that wrong?
No, you know, I think it's the reality of California politics that we've had for 100 years and we'll have for another 100.
So you're cool with it.
In one form or another.
That didn't seem to be
your
headline.
There are a lot of tricks that Californians have worked out over this time period that actually do lead to sort of better decisions than you might think when you say, 224 pages, 17 decisions, no one's ever going to be able to do anything. And by... You know, what I think political scientists, many of them coming from UCSD, have shown us is that following the shortcuts, right, of the endorsements, right? So some people go to Voice of San Diego and read those things, but really what people are going to do is find out, well, where's Jerry Brown on this one? Where's the, you know, NARAL on this one? You know, where are the groups that I care about, the League of Women Voters, right? By following those shortcuts and reading those short ballot descriptions, people make decisions that a lot of polls show are pretty
in keeping
with their policies.
Honestly, I think it's cool that California gets that I wonder whether problems outside this state, like I have a house in Maryland and I also have a house in Washington, D.C., and for complicated reasons, I don't vote in both places, but I pretend to be aware, is that I feel in certain states voters get talked down to or get censored. Here in California, I mean, I sort of feel like I think it would be cool to have this many initiatives. And I don't feel as talked down to by the system. Am I wrong?
It is cool, except there's 31. I mean, and some of them have enormous consequences.
Oh, my God,
on
31 choices and decisions.
Well, some of them have to do with hotel taxes. And we just reviewed one, a Measure J. Does anybody know what Measure J in the city does? Yeah, see, there's like one person. This thing would change the formula of Matt. Oh, he's gone. Well, this thing changed the formula of how parks are funded, and it's a really complex thing. And it's
Measure H changes to the city's purchasing and contracting process.
See, yeah, see, that's not controversial.
Measure
do
J,
that.
Money for Mission Bay and other parks.
Yeah, Measure J.
I've got them all here.
Yeah, Measure I has this this charter change for the city and the park and San Diego High School. There's so many of these things that are extremely complex, and a good portion of them have to go to the ballot. Bilingual education in the state, that was a change that was done by initiative.
How about
that,
Measure M, raising the cap on affordable housing units? Where are you on that?
That's just one of these dumb things that they because it's in the charter, it has to get changed, and it's like it has no controversy about it, and it must change. And I think there's other things, like should we raise the hotel room tax to pay for a new stadium downtown, a Convadium? And there's
who's for the stadium? I don't want to
not
give everybody
a single
chance,
hand.
Right? So that's why we have direct democracy, right? Because okay. If it were up to elected officials, right, there's tremendous, don't lose the Chargers on your watch, Mayor, there's tremendous incentives not to do this. And another thing the system sort of, it makes people more educated, lots of polling shows that makes them more engaged, you see higher turnout, especially when you see these big ballots. But third, it detaches what we think about politicians individually from our policy positions. So California was able to do things like have Prop 13. So as a tax revolt that happens, and California doesn't have to throw out all the Democrats in charge of the legislature. They're going to have a tax revolt and keep social liberals in the legislature at a key time. Whereas if you have to tie all of your politics together, you got to elect social liberals or social conservatives and fiscal conservatives at once if you want to lower your taxes.
I want to ask you in as clean a sentence or a couple of sentences you can. What do you think, if you were to frame a question for Lester Holt in the debate Monday night, what question would you pose to Hillary and Donald Trump?
I had a good one. I would ask...
See, this is when you know the cards are not stacked and we didn't coordinate at all.
Look of terror on our faces.
I think the scariest thing that Donald Trump has said is that he would deport up to 12 million people who are living here.
Okay, so put it as a question.
And I would say, are you literally going to mobilize the security and big brother systems that would need to be mobilized to forcibly, eject 12 million people? Are you really going to do that? And I would love to, keep hounding him until he was clear on that. That's the most terrifying and potentially disruptive thing I think that he has outlined. And I think it's something we need to grapple with, and he needs to be on stage to grapple with.
Laura?
So tough. Okay, I'm going to let Thad go first, and then I'll bring it home.
All right.
Thad?
For Hillary Clinton, the fundamental question of this campaign has been, are you going to change the course, or are we going to see 4 more years of Barack Obama? How are you going to change the direction of America?
Oh, I have a good one.
I think Laura wants more time anyway.
I do, actually.
The wall. What is the actual wall in Texas? Because Texas has a river. Are you talking about putting a wall on our side of the river, which means we don't have access to the river? Or are you going to get Mexico to put it on their side of the river because they're going to do that? And that's not... And that's... I would love for him to grapple with that. And then he'll say, well, it's not really a wall. And that would be huge. I would love for him to say it. So they
should... I'm going to email all this to Lester Holt. Laura, you're on stage.
I think I would ask either of them if there was anyone that they wanted to apologize to. Is there any sort of contrition that they would like to give? And then I would also ask Donald Trump...
Apologize to in what sphere?
Well, it gives them the opportunity to sort of be empathetic and to, again, reiterate anything that they regretted. I mean, I think it gives Hillary an opportunity to build out her trustworthy numbers. It gives Donald Trump an opportunity to be less combative, to show he has the temperament to admit his mistakes. So I feel like the apology would give them an open floor, and either they're going to sit there and nod or they're going to actually say something. So that would be my question to both of them. And then I'm really fascinated by Donald Trump's relationship to his foundation, especially in light of the fact that the foundation is now paying legal bills for him. So that fascinates
me. Investigative journalism.
scratching the surface. I want more. I love it.
Fascinating. Let's give a round of applause to Scott Lewis, Laura Fink, and Thad Kauser. Really fascinating, rich discussion. Honestly, I wish we had another hour to go. So thank you all very, very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.